Welcome, everyone. Today is May 15th, 2021. We're going to start on the fourth handout of our course notes. This is about language learning. Language learning is a very important topic for language revitalization because we want to help people learn their language. How can we do that? We can start by understanding as much as we can about how people learn language. Let's cover some of the terms we'll be using in this handout. We'll start with acquisition. Acquisition means to acquire or to learn something. Linguists often use the word acquire or acquisition when we talk about learning a language. And to many linguists, acquisition is different from learning. When we learn a language as adults, what we're doing is we're learning because we're conscious of what we're doing. But when children, infants, learn a language the natural way, just by being around it, hearing it spoken around them, that's called acquisition. And when we compare the way that infants acquire their language to the way that adults learn a second language, we find quite a few differences. Next, we'll be talking about target language. In this course and in Neuchanalth language revitalization generally, the target language is Neuchanalth. That is the language we're trying to learn or trying to teach to other people. That's the language we're trying to get to. The language that we already all share is English. Everyone in this class speaks English, but we speak Neuchanalth at different skill levels. Neuchanalth is our target language. We'll also talk about first language and second language, or for short, L1 and L2. Your first language, or L1, is the language that you have heard since you were an infant, the one that you grew up with, your native language, if you like. Your second language, or L2, is a language that you started learning later in life. So for many of us, English was our first language, and then we started learning a second language sometime later in life. You might have studied French as a second language in high school. For some of you, Neuchanalth might be a second language. Neuchanalth is a second language for me. My first language is English. Neuchanalth is a second language. Tom is the opposite. Tom and Moses, for them, Neuchanalth is their first language. That was the language that was spoken to them when they were infants. And English is a second language for them. The way linguists mean native language is equivalent to first language. And this can be confusing in the context of studying First Nations languages, because in the context of First Nations, native is often synonymous with First Nations. But when linguists talk about a native language, what they mean is a first language. That is the language that you've had from birth. The last term in our terms list is language immersion. Immersion means that you're completely surrounded by a language and you use only that language. So most of us have experienced immersion in English for most of our lives. That's the language that we hear and speak most of the time. But in order to help bring back Neuchanalth, one of the things we want to create is immersion in Neuchanalth. That is, we want to give people the chance to hear only Neuchanalth and to speak only Neuchanalth. That would be immersion. That's it for our terms for now. Now's a good time to ask any clarification questions about these terms. We'll start by, go ahead. Here are some of the differences that linguists think they've seen in how young children learn their first language and how adults learn a language. Let's talk about first languages first. We generally see that everyone acquires a first language. It is extremely unusual for a person to grow up and not speak the language that is spoken around them when they're an infant. Also, they don't have to try to do it. It just seems to happen. They don't do it on purpose. Third, there seems to be what linguists call a critical period. That's roughly between the ages of birth and 5 years of old. As long as a child starts learning their first language during that critical period, they learn to speak it fluently. If someone starts studying a language after that period, they seem not to learn it as fluently as infants do. Fourth, the learning of a first language, an L1, seems to involve several stages. For example, first, infants listen a lot, but they don't speak. Then they start babbling. They say ba ba, ma ma, things that don't make any sense, but they are making sounds. Then they start using single words. Then they start using two words together. And eventually they start using long, full sentences like adults do. Last, the final stage of L1 acquisition is fluency. If a person goes through all of these stages from hearing a language from birth or close to it, babbling, one-word utterances, two-word utterances, during the appropriate critical period, they almost always speak their language fluently. It is very unusual for a person to go through these experiences and not speak a language fluently. Now let's compare that to L2. Whereas everyone learns a first language, not everyone learns a second language. Also, L2 learning is conscious and purposeful. People try to learn a second language. It doesn't happen without them trying. Third, L2 learning doesn't seem to have a critical period. We can learn a second language anytime during our lives, and the outcome is similar. It is true that people get worse and worse at it as they get older. But once we're past that age of five, there's not that much difference between how a 20-year-old, for example, learns a second language and how a 40-year-old learns a second language. Last, if we start learning a language as a second language, we rarely learn to speak it fluently. We might learn, if we have get lots and lots of practice, we might be able to make very good sentences, but people who learn a language after the critical period almost always speak it with an accent. I started learning Nuchanalth when I was about 35, and I can make lots of sentences of Nuchanalth. I can understand lots of sentences of Nuchanalth, but I have an accent when I speak Nuchanalth, and I will always have an accent. I don't think that I will ever speak with quite as good native pronunciation as Tom and Moses do, because they have heard the language from birth. That's a brief overview of the differences that linguists see between language acquisition, that is L1 acquisition, and language learning, that is learning of a second language. Since trauma has come up, I'd like to say a few words about that and invite your input as well. Language trauma is not a focus of this course, but it is something very important that we have to take into account when we're working on language acquisition. And the reason is that in Nuchanalth communities, we are still observing a long period of language loss, and there is a lot of trauma associated with that. The trauma of, for many people, of going through residential school and not being allowed to speak their language, or of being one of the following generations who didn't go to residential school but were raised by people who did, and some of those attitudes. And pain has been passed down. So, and I want to say that as a white American who grew up in Seattle and other big cities, that's not part of my experience. I do not associate any trauma with Nuchanalth because I come from such a different background. And sometimes I forget that my Nuchanalth friends and colleagues do have. Each have their own trauma associated with this. So, any of you who are going to work in language revitalization need to also be sensitive to where your friends and colleagues and your students are at, what they might have experienced, what trauma they might be carrying that is complicating their effort to learn their language. Now that we've talked in general terms about the differences between acquiring a first language and learning a second language, we're going to look at several language learning strategies. And the main thing we're interested in is what strategies should we use to learn the language ourselves? What strategies should we teach to other people to help them learn the language? The first approach that we'll talk about is the natural approach. The natural approach was proposed by Krashen and Terrell in the 1980s. And generally speaking, what Krashen and Terrell thought is that the best way to learn a second language is to try to learn it as similarly as possible to how infants learn their first language. So, for example, infants learn their language subconsciously. They don't have to think about it, they just do it. Adults, on the other hand, tend to be quite self-conscious. It's hard for us to forget ourselves and just surrender ourselves to the experience of learning the language. So Krashen and Terrell said that adult learners need to be comfortable. If they're not comfortable, they're not going to learn. Second, they expect that language learning, even L2 learning, will happen in stages, similarly to L1 learning. Third, L2 learners must be presented with input that they can understand. So if you're a beginner learner, an adult learner of Nuchanoth, and you're just starting out, according to Krashen and Terrell, it would be counterproductive to give you very fast, complex, fluent speech. Instead, you should be presented with simpler, slower speech with a smaller vocabulary. And then once you get comfortable with that, you can be presented with something one stage beyond that. And once you get comfortable with that, one stage beyond that. So they think the natural approach says that the best L2 learning happens when learners are comfortable and allowed to learn gradually. The next approach we'll talk about is total physical response, or TPR. I'm sure some of you have heard about TPR before. It's been very popular for the last 20 years or so. The basic idea behind TPR is that people learn well when they're active, when they're moving. Not just sitting in a chair and listening and speaking, but moving around. So the TPR approach tries to combine learning, listening, speaking with movement. We do activities. When we say takishi'i, which means stand up, we actually stand up. And then tikwasi'i, sit down. We sit down. The teacher models this for the students, and the students copy them. And the idea is that when you're engaging your active body along with your language learning, both will happen better. This approach means that a lot of the material presented in the TPR method is in the form of commands, right? So we're not having conversations like, I love you, I love you too. What's your name? My name is Adam. Rather, most of the language is happening with commands. Come here, sit down, stand up, tell me your name. Instead of what is your name, tell me your name. That is a very brief summary of the TPR approach. Next, let's talk about the language nest approach. The language nest approach originated in New Zealand in the 1980s. The native language of New Zealand is called Maori, and the Maori people in the 1980s found themselves in a similar situation to where Nuchanoth was around that time. That is, there were lots of elderly people who spoke the language fluently, but fewer and fewer young people who spoke the language. Furthermore, the parents of young children could not speak the language either. The infants were not able to learn the language from their parents, but it was still possible for them to learn it from their grandparents because there were still many grandparents who spoke it. So the idea was that children would be brought together in a kind of daycare called a nest. In the nest, there would be elderly fluent speakers who would speak only in Maori, And that way, the children grew up hearing the Maori language that they couldn't hear from their own parents. This approach has been quite successful in New Zealand. It is also in Hawaii. It is now possible in Hawaii to go to Hawaiian immersion schools all the way from preschool through university. We are very far off from being able to offer that kind of education in New Channel, but hopefully we will be able to do that someday if we can implement some kind of language nest approach. The next approach I'm going to talk about is the mentor-apprentice approach, but we've been together for more than an hour, so I think maybe we should take a break. The more or less standard reference for the mentor-apprentice approach is work by Leanne Hinton. In the mentor-apprentice approach, we pass on fluent knowledge of a language by pairing an older fluent speaker with a younger learner. The idea is that that learner gets very intensive, rich input by having lots of one-on-one attention with the mentor. In the past, this was called the master-apprentice approach, but a few years ago, we started calling it the mentor-apprentice approach instead. In this approach, the mentor and apprentice have to spend many, many hours together. They do things together. They cook, they clean, they relax, they watch TV, take walks, anything that gives them an opportunity to talk about what's happening around them, what they're doing. The idea is that the apprentice will get a very rich spectrum of the language, similar to what an infant growing up in a natural language learning environment would get. It was originally developed for teaching native Californian languages, that is, indigenous Californian languages, and it is now being used all over the world. Some of you, I believe, have taken part in mentor-apprentice teams. Next, let's talk about accelerated second language acquisition, or ASLA. Don't take too much out of the name of this approach. The name doesn't really say much about how the approach works, but I'll give you a general description of how it works. The ASLA method was created by Stephen Nayakit Graymorning, who is a fluent speaker of Arapaho, and he also teaches at the University of Montana in Missoula. The idea in the accelerated second language acquisition is to start speaking sentences as soon as possible. And at the beginning of the ASLA method, the teacher doesn't introduce a lot of words, but he starts combining those words into lots of different sentences. For example, I took a workshop in this method back in 2009, and ever since then I've used it in my language classes. At the beginning, some of the first words that we learn are words for man, woman, boy, girl, canoe, car, airplane, and some simple action words like walk, run, fly, drive, stand, sit. That's less than 20 words, but with those words, we can make hundreds of sentences. The man is walking, the man is standing, the man is sitting, the woman is standing, the woman is sitting, the woman sees the man, the car is going, the plane is flying, the eagle is flying, the crow is flying, and so on. These are very simple sentences, but once learners learn how to make simple sentences like these, we can start making slightly more and more complicated sentences, like the man said that the eagle is flying, the man saw the eagle flying, and so on. So, in summary, the ASLA method starts with a small vocabulary but gets learners to understand and make sentences very quickly. It is also very oral. So, learners do not read and write, they listen and speak. And Dr. Graymorning thinks this is crucial to learning to actually speak the language. The next method that we'll discuss is the shared stories method. This is not what the creators of this method call it, but that's what I call it. The person who pioneered this method, as far as I know, is Greg Thompson of the Summer Institute of Linguistics. The Summer Institute of Linguistics is the scientific and educational arm of the Wycliffe Bible Translators, who want to translate the Christian Bible into all the world's languages. So it is very important for the missionaries trained at the Summer Institute of Linguistics to be able to learn a language as quickly as possible so that they can start to work with fluent speakers to translate the Bible into that language. Here are the important elements of the shared stories method. The learner gets fluent speakers to share personal stories. They can talk about anything they want, how they grew up, what they did this morning, what they enjoyed doing. The learner records the story, makes a sound recording, maybe even a video recording. Then the learners listen to this over and over again. One of the advantages of this method is that it's not as time intensive on the part of the fluent speaker as, say, the mentor-apprentice approach is. In the mentor-apprentice approach, a single elder has to spend hundreds of hours with a single learner. But in the shared stories method, an individual fluent elder can spend much less time recording stories, and then because the learners are listening to the recording over and over again. This approach distinguishes active listening and passive listening. Passive listening is just listening. Active listening means you're listening to the recording and speaking along with it. So you can be speaking out loud or you can be speaking under your breath. But the idea is that you're not just listening, you're learning how to speak as you listen. I use this basic method, this method of active listening, all the time in my own learning. When I hear something new, or I learn someone share t corrects me, tells me a better way to say something that I just said, I will say it out loud. Not necessarily loudly, but I will say it out loud. I might just move my lips, but I am saying it. I'm using my mouth and my brain and my lungs to actually make the sounds. And that is much better practice than just listening. There's one more method that I'd like to talk about that's not on this handout because it's newer and I haven't yet had a chance to write it up on this handout. That method is the Where Are Your Keys method. Where are your keys? It's sure. We were talking about the Where Are Your Keys approach, and I've projected the handout again, even though Where Are Your Keys is not on the handout. Maybe I'll take it down so that you're not distracted and you can just look at my face and listen to my voice. Where Are Your Keys was invented by Evan Gardner. Evan Gardner's from Oregon, and he's an avid language learner, like I am. He loves learning languages. One of the languages that he learned was American Sign Language. He spent months with a fluent speaker of American Sign Language, that is, a fluent signer, in order to learn the language. He basically learned ASL, that is American Sign Language, in a mentor-apprentice situation. One of his best spoken languages is Spanish. He spent many years learning Spanish and even training to become a Spanish speaker. And he noticed that despite years of studying Spanish, he and other learners didn't really speak it very well. And he decided that what was missing was a leg up. I mentioned just a few minutes ago that when it can be very helpful to expose learners to fluent speech. In fact, it's absolutely crucial to expose learners to fluent speech if you want them to become fluent someday. But for older learners, that's usually not enough. They need something more than that. And in Evan's case, he decided that the leg up that was most useful is sign language. What he does is he speaks the target language, for example, Newchanoff, and he signs at the same time. So, for example, if this is the sign for here, when we say the Nichanoth word for hear, which is na'a, na'a means hearing, he would make the sign every time he says the word, na'a, na'a. If he wants to say, I hear you, na'asishsutil, na'asishsutil. Na'asishsutil has three parts, na'a, which means hearing, sish, which means I, and sutil, which means you. I hear you. And he would sign that. Na'a sish sutil. Na'a sish sutil. And he signs all the time while he's speaking the target language. What this does is it gives the learner a leg up because he's always introducing new words, right? Like every day they introduce two or four or eight new words. And along with those new words, they introduce the sign that goes along with them. When the learners first hear that word, they don't know what it means, but they see the sign that helps them guess what it is. It might take a few repetitions for them to get that new word, and the sign helps them keep up. It helps them remember, oh yeah, that means hearing. Oh yeah, that means I, and so on. Now, a drawback of this method is that it requires quite a large investment in learning a bunch of signs, like hundreds of signs that you're going to use to teach. But his experience with it is that learners of all ages, not just small children, but adults as well, really take to it. It's less daunting than just speaking the language, just immersion. A big advantage of it is that it enables us to avoid English. Usually, when we're practicing the language, we have to keep translating back to English, right, to help people keep up. But by signing, we avoid having to do that. And this is a great thing in language learning because if you're able to depend on your native language as a crutch, it makes you much less likely to start depending on that new language. But if the translation language is a third language, like sign, you don't have your native language as a crutch. So you will try harder to learn that new language. That's a short introduction to the Where Your Keys method. This is currently being used by the Squamish in North Vancouver, by the Kwakokiwak on Northern Vancouver Island, and some Nuchanoth groups are starting to experiment with the Where Your Keys method. I attended a workshop with the Tsleil-Waututh language group a couple of months ago, where Evan and his team showed us the method over about a week. Well, that is all of the language teaching approaches that we're going to discuss in this course. We talked about the natural approach, total physical response, language nest, mentor apprentice, ASLA, shared stories, and where are your keys? That's seven different language teaching methods. I expect, if your experience is anything like mine, you'll find that whatever you're doing with Nuchanoth language, you will want to use some combination of these approaches. We're going to spend a little bit of time comparing these approaches, talking about their pluses and minuses, so that this can help us decide whatever we're doing, whether we're teaching the language or supporting someone else to teach it or learn it, deciding what parts of these approaches to use. Let me first ask you exercise 11. This will be our first discussion on, or rather, our next discussion on language learning. Which of these language learning strategies, these seven strategies that we've just talked about, are immersion strategies? I'm putting this in the recorded lecture because I don't think I mentioned it earlier. Pictures are very important in the ASLA method. Dr. Graymorning has the walls of his classroom completely wallpapered in pictures that he's taken out of magazines or printed from the internet because he points to those pictures when he's talking about stuff. You know, if he says the man saw that the eagle is flying, he points at a picture of a man watching an eagle, or he points at a picture of a man, he points at a picture that shows seeing, and he points at a picture that shows an eagle. So In a way, he's using pictures as the leg up, in a very similar way to how Where Are Your Keys uses sign language as the leg up. Exercise 12 asks, when learning a language, is it helpful to read and write? If so, why or why not? Is it helpful to learn to read and write when you're learning to speak a language? Okay, just one more question. Exercise 13. When learning a language, is it helpful to have a conscious understanding of the grammar? So, for example, is it helpful to be taught things like a sentence consists of a subject and a predicate? Some words are verbs, some words are nouns. These are endings that go on words that convey important things like who the sentence is about. Is it helpful to learn that kind of thing?